Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage's completely online process lets you get a custom mortgage solution wherever and whenever you want. Check out Rocket Mortgage at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Donald Trump said on the campaign trail that he would drain the swamp in Washington. Now, Washington, from Capitol Hill to the White House and beyond, will be Republican-run. Donald Trump has convincingly won in the Electoral College. The popular vote has gone to Hillary Clinton. Where does this divided nation go from here? This hour, On Point, Washington, power and policy. After the Trump election, you can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. How do you envision this country, federal policy, the future in a Trump presidency? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We're also streaming on Facebook Live today. Find us at facebook.com/onpointradio. Early this morning, Trump talking to the country. Here's a man in an interview with AFP at a Trump victory party in Miami early this morning.
I'm excited for America. I'm not here to support a party by itself. I'm here to support the well-being of my country. And America has spoken. We are not a third world country. And our democracy says that we should always be for the people.
How do we go there? How do we get there under a President Trump? With us from New York right now is Yamiche Alcindor, reporter and videographer covering national politics for the New York Times. Yamiche Alcindor, welcome to you. Welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Good to be here.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beattie is with us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom and Yamiche.
I should say that Hillary Clinton is expected to deliver her concession speech any time now, and we will go to that when and if she steps to the podium. So stick right here, and we will have it. Yamiche, how does this work in Washington? You've got a Republican Party divided against itself during this campaign. You've got an electoral victory for Donald Trump, a popular vote that went to Hillary Clinton. How does it work functionally in the nation's capital on the other side of Inauguration Day?
I think what we're going to see is Donald Trump really trying to push, truly trying to push through and pass the policies that he really rode this wave of populism to get to this position. He's promised people that he's going to build a wall across Mexico, even though there are Republicans who say that that's something that doesn't seem like that's possible and it's going to be too expensive. He's promised people that he's going to, in his first 100 days, deport millions of people. He has to follow through on that. He's promised that he's going to renegotiate NAFTA. He has to follow through on that. So he's going to be pushing through these things because he owes it to the people who got him here, because these are the people that I think would very quickly turn on him if they sense that he is now playing party politics. So I think we're going to see a lot of internal fighting within the Republican Party.
Jack, will he deliver? Can he deliver?
Well, you know, a columnist for the Pittsburgh Gazette observed about Trump's positions that the elite takes them literally, but not seriously, and Trump supporters take them seriously, but not literally. That is to say, the wall, the deportation, and so on, that's symbolic politics as much as anything else, and it's that connected with the electorate. I'm not so sure that if he doesn't build a wall, he's going to suffer among his constituents, perhaps. But I do think at that symbolic level, people taking him seriously but not literally, they know he means to crack down. They know that illegal, quote-unquote, illegal immigration will be constrained. And that may be enough.
Yamiche, do you buy that? Or are you saying that he's got an electorate to put him in the White House now that expects to see, you know, busloads, trainloads, whatever it is, of people headed south and a wall going up on the southern border?
I think that he has millions of people who want him and expect him to build a wall across the border of Mexico. I've been out there talking to people for months, and people, when I talk to them about why they're voting for him, they clearly say that these are the things, they list the things. I know that there's and sometimes the characterization of Trump supporters are that they're uneducated working class whites, but the people that I've talked to know very much about NAFTA. They know the intricacies of trade policies. They can name these trade policies, and I think, which is something that really wasn't something that I think a lot of people were really focused on before this election. So I think if he does not build a wall, if he does not bring jobs back to rural places across this country who overwhelmingly supported him, that he is going to face a quick backlash, and it's going to be something that's going to really, I think, shake his administration, because he is, this is a populist movement. And the moment that people think that he's not doing what he promised, they're going to rebel against him. And I think that that's very clear. I think this, I don't think there's symbolism. When I talk to people in rural Pennsylvania, they don't think that it's symbolic that he's saying he's going to build a wall. They're saying that he's going to physically put a wall up.
Hillary Clinton coming for a concession speech soon. Jack Beatty, you know, there's a promise, and Yamiche's been out there talking with people, and they expect it. They expect to see it. So what does Donald Trump do? Can he really shine them on after all the times he's repeated these things? And if he cannot, will Republicans work with him to do it?
Well, you know, Hamilton in The Federalist speaks of energy in the executive as paramount. I think we're going to see great energy in the executive, starting right from the first day when he's going to, rescind a raft of Obama-era regulations, starting with the repeal of Obamacare, which will probably come to him very shortly, and starting with an ambitious tax cut program that exceeds George W. Bush's, really, and that might even have some tax reform in it. So I just think there's going to be such a sense of energy and go from this man, at least to start, that will buy him time to please his supporters, who that's what they voted for. They voted for change, and they are going to get a whirlwind of it.
Yamiche, how does he put jobs back in those areas where they have not been? That's been a struggle for decades now. And even if jobs do come back, there's so much talk about automation and robotics. How would Donald Trump actually do that? Does he bring in infrastructure spending to do that? How do you make factories spring up?
I think you're going to have to maybe renegotiate, trade deals to try to figure out how to penalize American companies that are choosing to build factories or to have factories in Mexico. But that might also mean that that goods in America are going to be more expensive. But really, most people, including Donald Trump supporters, haven't really seen the actual blueprints of how he would bring jobs back to America. People have told me just that they feel as though they trust him, that he did do this. And they say, he has a plan. And even if he doesn't want to tell us all the plans or doesn't want to broadcast the plans, we know that he's going to do this. The idea is that he was really helpful and really successful, I should say, in building this image of him as a successful businessman, and people trust that he is, even though he did not release his tax returns, and we really aren't sure exactly how much he's worth. But the idea is that people really believe that he can do this.
There's image, there's national policy, and then there's national policy that actually works. Big, big challenges out of the rhetoric there. Yamiche Alcindor, Jack Beatty, please stand by. Eliana Johnson joins us right now from Philadelphia. She's Washington editor for the National Review. Eliana, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
What's the power relationship going to work like between Capitol Hill and the White House? Do you anticipate? You've got Paul Ryan, at least for now, as Speaker of the House. You've got Mitch McConnell down there, head of the Senate. You'll have Donald Trump sitting in the Oval Office. Who steers the ship? Who really runs this?
Well, I think this is perhaps the thing to watch going forward. Donald Trump has, until now, had quite a fractious relationship with his fellow Republicans. Paul Ryan came out about a month ago in the wake of that infamous Access Hollywood tape and essentially freed Republicans to disavow him and run their own campaigns. The chairman of the National Republican Senatorial Campaign Committee did that far longer ago. telling Republican senators to run their own campaigns, and many of them did disavow Donald Trump. So he has not had a close relationship with his fellow Republicans. One of the interesting dynamics, I think, to watch is that many of the Republicans reelected last night, the Republican senators in particular, Pat Toomey in Pennsylvania, Ron Johnson in Wisconsin, Marco Rubio in Florida, Rand Paul in Kentucky, were elected in 2010 in this Tea Party wave that people thought was a ideology of conservative, purist. Mm-hmm. And I think Trump has revealed or transformed it into something of a populist fury. And the way that Republicans and conservatives grapple with that and the interplay between the two of Republicans and conservatives and the populism Trump represents and how that plays out is the essential dynamic to watch going forward.
We have lots of callers for all of you as we also wait for Hillary Clinton and her concession speech. Steve in Southfield, Michigan. Steve, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. I've been listening to CNN, MSNBC, and the talking hairdos who are already giving this man a pass, saying things like, well, he gave such a cordial and conciliatory acceptance speech last night. He has preyed upon the legitimate desperation and misery of hundreds of millions of Americans. Just a few hours ago, many of us were talking about the fact that if he's not a fascist and a demagogue, he's certainly doing a very good impression of one.
But preyed upon the misery, Steve, he would say, I'm responding to the misery, to the pleas, if that's what it is.
He is. He absolutely is. And that's what demagogues and fascists do. I am your salvation. I alone can lead you out of the wilderness.
So what do you say to people who felt abandoned, who felt not spoken to? What were they supposed to wait on?
You know, that's an excellent point, but certainly not a demagogue and a fascist. I have a 15-year-old daughter who is absolutely distraught. Oh, my God, Dad, she said. He's president. I have a friend who said, well, Steve, don't terrify her too much. And, you know, Trump's talking sensibly now. And I said, but I didn't terrify her. He did. People wanted, you know, your guest said something about there are people, the apologists for Trump are already saying things like metaphorically, well, his supporters take him seriously, but not literally. You must take him literally. When he said that, He assaulted women and grabbed them by their genitals. He wasn't speaking metaphorically. He was speaking literally.
Steve, and we've got it. I appreciate your call from Michigan. We're up against a break right here. Eliana Johnson, Yamiche Alcindor, Jack Beatty, please stand by. We're talking Washington power policy. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about Washington power and policy after the Trump election. What comes now? With Yamiche Alcindor of the New York Times with us from New York. In Philadelphia, Eliana Johnson joins us, Washington editor for the National Review, conservative though hadn't supported Donald Trump. Jack Beatty is with us, On Point News analyst. You can join us as well. What do you want? What do you expect from a Trump presidency? How do you picture America under Trump? Republicans, what's the vision? What's the philosophy here? Is there a unified one or something else? And Democrats, what's the way? Work with? Dig in? Against? What will it mean when all three branches of government are essentially Republican, led by Donald Trump? Paul Ryan speaking. Hillary Clinton expected to, at some point this morning, to make her concession speech, hours now after Donald Trump has declared his victory. In that speech, he sent a message to the world, he said, about how America would deal with other nations.
I want to tell the world community that while we will always put America's interests first, we will deal fairly with everyone, all people and all other nations. We will seek common ground, not hostility, partnership, not conflict.
Jack Beatty, how do you read, big picture, what has happened in this election outcome? You could see early yesterday, just listen or watch. And many, many were expecting Hillary Clinton there. It is not Hillary Clinton in the winner's circle at the end. How do you read what's happened in these months, Jack?
Well, you know, Tom, at one level, this was structurally inevitable. Alan Abramovitz, the political scientist, has this model, the time for a change model. And even at the start of this campaign, he looked at it and he said, this predicts a generic, that a generic Republican will beat any Democrat. Why? Because third terms are time for a change. People just want change. It's only once in the post-war era that we've had a party three terms.
You got the least generic Republican ever, Jack.
Yes, but this proves in a way Abramovitz's acumen that it doesn't seem to matter what the campaign is when there's this desire for change. We saw it in the Democratic primary. That was all about, we can't go on as we are, we have to change. And what was Hillary Clinton's message? She was really, once Sanders threatened her, she embraced the Obama administration fully. And that seemed to help her. But it also wedded her to the status quo and to so many of Trump's supporters and even so many people who just itch for a change that would benefit them, perhaps. They haven't seen it. That was part of the movement. On the other side, you know, you can't miss the economic grievances of Trump voters. Eight in ten said that their personal finances are the same or worse than 4 years ago. 75% said the economy was not good or poor. And President Obama, what does he say all the time? Well, the economy is booming. Things are great. Unemployment. That's not the existential experience of the Trump voter. So these things, this economic business, this time for a change, and then third, you just can't miss it. There's an element of racial resentment and what Van Jones called white lash here. Rural white America has been gagging on the new America now for a decade and more, and their status is threatened by that, and they're reacting against it.
Paul Ryan saying in this hour that Donald Trump has pulled off what he's calling the most incredible political feat he's seen in his lifetime. Paul Ryan, Speaker of the House, Republican, saying this needs to be a time of redemption, saying that it will be a unified Republican government. We'll look at that. Yamiche Alcindor, Eliana Johnson, please stand by. Jack, you're talking about change. One of the changes that Hillary certainly would have represented had to do with gender. Many anticipated the first woman in the White House. That has not happened. Ellen Goodman joins us right now, Pulitzer Prize-winning former columnist for the Boston Globe, the Washington Post Writers Group. She's been watching and writing about women's issues for many, many years. Ellen Goodman, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Your reaction to the outcome of the 2016 presidential election, Ellen?
Well, despair? Can I go directly to the gut? I thought so much last night and this morning of the first interview I ever had with Hillary Clinton, which was in 1992, when she said that I am a Rorschach test for how people feel about changes in women's roles. And I think that remains a very strong theme of this election. There was a huge gender gap. Let's remember that she's won the popular vote, by the way, so it isn't
yes.
a blowout in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
But there, we arrived, we got through this, the narrative of this election between a overqualified woman and a man who has never had a role in government. And that is an incredible disparity. At the same time, that overqualified woman somehow became seen as establishment. And that was another amazing thing. Since we've never had a woman president in our lives, she was not seen as change. She was seen by many as establishment.
But surely she was establishment. I guess she'd been first lady. She'd been in the Senate. She'd been secretary of state. I mean, that is in the midst of our power structure.
Sure, absolutely. But any woman had to have like this super resume,
yeah.
And then with this incredible resume, you become denigrated as a member of the establishment in this era, too. And let's remember, there was a huge gender gap also in this election, and a huge gender gap between college-educated white men and women, a huge,
yes.
And then the gender gap disappeared entirely among non-college educated whites. So that was still a, it was still, Trump beat Clinton 53-41 among men, and Clinton won 54-42 among women. So that's a pretty startling difference. I think the other thing that sort of I'm very conscious of in terms of her original comment about being seen as a Rorschach test is that somehow I hope this doesn't be seen, this election doesn't come to be seen particularly by younger women as, well, I guess it's okay for men to sexually assault or to be seen as crude towards women, because there has been such a huge change in public attitude about that, and yet Donald Trump represents the non-change.
She came so close to the highest, hardest glass ceiling. There's a glass ceiling that was intended to be above her in a victory speech last night. That is not broken. Do you think the proximity of Hillary Clinton to the White House means women are closer now, Ellen, or does her loss mean that dream of many women of finally seeing a woman as leader of the country seem further out of reach with this loss?
Well, I hope that a lot more women start feeling comfortable to run for office. But there's that other vision of just how hard it was, that many of us thought that the first woman would sort of stride into the White House, you know, flame overhead. And yet she was crawling on cracked glass in the last days, and she did not, she did not crack that glass ceiling at all. In fact, she was pretty cut up by it.
Ellen Goodman, it's wonderful to have you with us today. Thank you for joining us a minute on this day after the vote. Thank you very much, Ellen.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Pulitzer Prize-winning former columnist for the Boston Globe, Washington Post Writers Group, Ellen Goodman. Yamiche, you were on the trail a lot. What about gender and the trail? And what about Washington on the other side of Hillary Clinton's loss? And does it become a male preserve of power in even more magnified terms or not?
Well, I really find it hard to discuss gender without also discussing race, because this election was just so much about race. I wrote a story a couple of weeks ago about that, the Trump sex tapes, or the Trump tapes, I should say. And that story was about the idea that women that he was really attacking white women, and that was when other fellow Republicans could then see their daughters and their wives and their mothers in the people that he was targeting. Before that, he had been talking about Mexican women. He had been talking about black women. And I think that it would be a real failure as reporters, I'll put myself in that, if we focus so much on gender and not understand that this is all about intersectionality, and that the people who put Donald Trump into office maybe don't understand intersectionality.
Do you see white men as back in the saddle then? Is that what you're taking in part from this, Yamiche?
I think what they're taking in part from this is that people are anxious about losing their grip on what America looks like and what America literally looks like, and the values that they consider America to have held at some point. Of course, the America was founded on so many things that we now consider to be racist and sexist. But the idea is that people, think of America as having these values. But I think that what this says is that I don't think it says that Washington is a place that's only for men or only for white men, because Hillary Clinton did go very far. And in some ways she was in the establishment candidate. She was talking about the idea that she was going to continue a lot of Obama's policies, that she was going to improve Obamacare. So I think that Hillary Clinton had a set of flaws that made her even have to trudge through the primaries. You saw Bernie Sanders really go after her and talk about the fact that she had bad judgment. So I think that she had a set of issues that I don't think it's just that she was a woman. I think that there were a set of issues that were really hurting her.
Eliana Johnson, we've got Paul Ryan talking about a unified Republican government right now. Jack Beatty was saying before you joined us that you talk about energy in the executive as a hallmark that we might see from Donald Trump. If Donald Trump is energetically pursuing some of the policies that he championed on the campaign trail, Eliana, which are at odds with traditional Republican orthodoxy, what happens to this unified Republican government? Eliana, are you there?
I am.
Yes, you're on.
Thanks. I think it's easy to see Trump working with Republicans in Congress and in the Senate on some things. Immigration is one of them. But in many ways, Trump is a departure from traditional Republican orthodoxy, most visibly on entitlement reform, which he has said he doesn't want to touch entitlements. And that's something that Paul Ryan in his budgets has made a major issue out of, tackling Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security. Trump's majorly departed from Republican orthodoxy on trade. And I think he will butt heads with Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and with House Speaker Paul Ryan on that. So it's difficult for me to see them working constructively together if they're butting heads on some major issues. Trump is not a conservative. And in many ways, he only recently became a Republican. He spent most of his life as a Democrat. He then became an independent. So I do think there are discrete issues on which they can work together, perhaps tax reform, immigration. But on some major issues important to conservatives, foreign policy, entitlement reform, trade, Trump and Republican leaders are very likely to butt heads.
What happens when that? Does Paul Ryan get kicked out? Does the Freedom Caucus rise up and say no? Do Republicans jump onto the horse that Donald Trump has ridden into the White House? Do we have a new gridlock with the GOP itself, gridlocked within, against itself?
You know, I don't think anybody knows right now what the dynamics will be, but the Freedom Caucus is an interesting group to look at. You know, they are the most conservative group of members in Congress, drove John Boehner, former House Speaker John Boehner, out of his office because he was not ideologically conservative enough, but then stayed relatively silent about Donald Trump's candidacy despite his departures from conservative orthodoxy. That said, they really have, I think, been looking for the chance to fight back against a Republican president who has not been seen as sufficiently conservative. And I think there's a good chance that that they will take the chance to do that. They are people who like to be in the spotlight and in front of the cameras. And I think if they can work with House Speaker Paul Ryan to distinguish themselves and push back against a Republican president, there is a good chance that they'll do that.
David in Detroit, Michigan. David, thank you for calling. You're on the air on this morning after. David, thanks for joining us.
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Hi, what do you see?
I wanted to... Oh, go ahead.
What do you see, David?
Well, I wanted to speak on both Trump's support, where it comes from, because I think it's a little bit more diverse than people think or that it appears. And the second thing I wanted to speak on is why people move to a Trump, because I don't think that was... You know, I think a lot of people didn't expect that to shake out that way in the end, but I think there is a real clear reason why.
Let's hear it. What is it, David?
So the first thing is I talked to a young Arab man at in Taylor, which is a working class suburb of Detroit, and he said that he was voting for Donald Trump, and it kind of took me aback, and I asked him why, and he says, well, what has Hillary Clinton's policy been in the Middle East? And I think there's been a long history, the last, at least since Bill Clinton, where the Democrats have moved more and more openly towards positions that are not that far from Reagan or the Republicans. Obama and Bush shared No Child Left Behind or Race to the Top. They're very similar in terms of the way they attack education. The very pro-business, if you cut taxes or give grants to businesses, they'll grow and somehow create jobs. And that largely has not panned out, especially not with jobs that can actually support people on a living wage. And so when you run as kind of like a Republican light, and then also get that as, an insider or as part of a corrupt status quo, which I think a lot of people from both right and the left view things as now, which is where you get a Sanders and a Trump from. One of the other interesting things I found was that I had a lot of people who said because Sanders was not in the race that they would vote for Trump. Merely because he was an outsider. And I think because there is only a candidate on the right who is validating people's real legitimate anger in the way things are, that's the only place that they see to go. And I think traditionally, the working, working class people in this country have had a left option, whether that be unions or, grassroots things or illusions in a section of a Democratic Party that at least pays lip service to them. But
not so much this time and not after Sanders. David, we're up against a break here. Jack Beatty, Hillary Clinton harvesting Bill Clinton's third way centrism here with a defeat.
Certainly on NAFTA, certainly on the sense of a business-friendly, domestic policy. Yes, and perhaps even with African Americans to some extent, with predators and that sort of thing, and the three strikes you're out. Who knows?
Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage brings home financing into the 21st century with a completely online process that's fast, easy, and convenient. Using a phone or tablet, you can safely share bank statements and pay stubs without having to dig through piles of paperwork. It takes just a few minutes to get a custom mortgage solution on your terms, wherever and whenever you want. Check out Rocket Mortgage at quickenloans.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Washington power and policy after the Trump election. What comes next? What comes now? Hillary Clinton now stepping to the podium in New York to concede, we expect, in this election. And we will bring you her remarks. Elena Johnson, Michelle Cinder, Jack Beatty, please stand by. Hillary Clinton at the microphone after a very, very long night.
Thank you all very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much. Very rowdy group.
Bill Clinton and Tim Kaine just beside her on either
Thank
side.
Thank you, my friends. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so very much for being here. And I love you all, too. Last night, I congratulated Donald Trump and offered to work with him on behalf of our country. I hope that he will be a successful president for all Americans. This is not the outcome we wanted or we worked so hard for. And I'm sorry that we did not win this election for the values we share and the vision we hold for our country. But I feel pride and gratitude for this wonderful campaign that we built together, this vast, diverse, creative, unruly, energized campaign. You represent the best of America, and being your candidate has been one of the greatest honors of my life. I know how disappointed you feel because I feel it too. And so do tens of millions of Americans who invested their hopes and dreams in this effort. This is painful, and it will be for a long time. But I want you to remember this. Our campaign was never about one person or even one election. It was about the country we love and about building an America that's hopeful, inclusive, and big-hearted. We have seen that our nation is more deeply divided than we thought. But I still believe in America, and I always will. And if you do, then we must accept this result and then look to the future. Donald Trump is going to be our president. We owe him an open mind and the chance to lead. Our constitutional democracy enshrines the peaceful transfer of power. And we don't just respect that, we cherish it. It also enshrines other things. the rule of law, the principle that we are all equal in rights and dignity, freedom of worship and expression. We respect and cherish these values too, and we must defend them. Now, and let me add, our constitutional democracy demands our participation, not just every 4 years, but all the time. So let's do all we can to keep advancing the causes and values we all hold dear, making our economy work for everyone, not just those at the top, protecting our country and protecting our planet, and breaking down all the barriers that hold any American back from achieving their dreams. We've spent a year and a half bringing together millions of people from every corner of our country to say with one voice that we believe big enough for everyone, for people of all races and religions, for men and women, for immigrants, for LGBT people, and people with disabilities, for everyone. So now, our responsibility as citizens is to keep doing our part to build that better, stronger, fairer America we seek. And I know you will. I am so grateful to stand with all of you. I want to thank Tim Kaine and Ann Holton for being our partners on this journey. It has been a joy getting to know them better, and it gives me great hope and comfort to know that Tim will remain on the front lines of our democracy representing Virginia in the Senate. To Barack and Michelle Obama, our country owes you an enormous debt of gratitude. We thank you for your graceful, determined leadership that has meant so much to so many Americans and people across the world. And to Bill and Chelsea, Mark, Charlotte, Aiden, our brothers and our entire family, my love for you means more than I can ever express. You crisscrossed this country on our behalf and lifted me up when I needed it most, even four-month-old Aiden, who traveled with his mom. I will always be grateful to the creative, talented, dedicated men and women at our headquarters in Brooklyn and across our country. You poured your hearts into this campaign. For some of you who are veterans, it was a campaign after you had done other campaigns. Some of you, it was your first campaign. I want each of you to know that you were the best campaign anybody could have ever expected or wanted. And to the millions of volunteers, community leaders, activists, and union organizers who knocked on doors, talked to neighbors, posted on Facebook, even in secret private Facebook sites. I want everybody coming out from behind that and make sure your voices are heard going forward. to everyone who sent in contributions as small as $5 and kept us going, thank you. Thank you from all of us. And to the young people in particular, I hope you will hear this. I have, as Tim said, spent my entire adult life fighting for what I believe in. I've had successes and I've had setbacks, sometimes really painful ones. Many of you are at the beginning of your professional, public, and political careers. You will have successes and setbacks too. This loss hurts, but please never stop believing that fighting for what's right is worth it. We need you to keep up these fights now and for the rest of your lives. And to all the women, and especially the young women, who put their faith in this campaign and in me, I want you to know that nothing has made me prouder than to be your champion. I know we have still not shattered that highest and hardest glass ceiling, but someday someone will, and hopefully sooner than we might think right now. And to all the little girls who are watching this, never doubt that you are valuable and powerful and deserving of every chance and opportunity in the world to pursue and achieve your own dreams. Finally, I am so grateful for our country and for all it has given to me. I count my blessings every single day that I am an American. And I still believe, as deeply as I ever have, that if we stand together and work together with respect for our differences, strength in our convictions, and love for this nation, our best days are still ahead of us. Because you know, I believe we are stronger together and we will go forward together. And you should never, ever regret fighting for that. You know, Scripture tells us, let us not grow weary in doing good, for in due season we shall reap if we do not lose heart. So, my friends, let us have faith in each other. Let us not grow weary. Let us not lose heart. For there are more seasons to come, and there is more work to do. I am incredibly honored and grateful to have had this chance to represent all of you in this consequential election. May God bless you, and may God bless the United States of America.
Hillary Clinton completing a concession speech there in New York, choking up as she talked about, and two women, young women especially, around the country. Eliana Johnson, Yamiche Alcindor, Jack Beatty, all with us. Eliana, can you imagine the depth of inner disappointment there as she makes this concession today, the morning after?
It really must be, as I think shocking to her as it was to everybody else. And when she talked about not shattering the glass ceiling now, but hoping somebody else will do it in the future, you know, I think it was unthinkable to her that she wouldn't win this election. And she will now be, it's possible, merely a footnote in history, which I think for the past 2 years, most journalists, frankly, have been thinking that she was set to be truly a major and remarkable figure in American history, the first female president.
Yamiche saying there that we cherish the Constitution for its peaceful transfer of power, kind of speaking to the moment and to Donald Trump there, but also speak to him when she says we also cherish from the Constitution the rule of law, respect for rights, freedom of religion, pointed constitutional reminders for President-elect Trump.
I think what we hear in Hillary Clinton is her really trying to convince the nation that we continue to go on, that people, both her support, mainly she's speaking, I think, to her supporters who are really distraught about Donald Trump being elected, that they have to respect that this is the way that American politics work, and that what makes America different from other countries is that we don't have civil wars, we don't break out into, you know, anger, that we don't let our anger spill over, but that we have peaceful transfers of power. So I think she's really trying to even already support a president-elect Trump in this way. And I think that is probably very painful for her. But I think she's already throwing her weight behind him in some ways and saying, you know, give him a chance.
Jack, a very valedictory sound there, not just from this campaign ending in failure ultimately, but it sounded almost as from the public stage in some way, Jack.
Yes, and you could see Bill Clinton struggling with his lip. Moved, and I was moved. I think everybody would be. The moving dignity of that speech, the composure, and she said not once but a couple of times, this isn't about me. This is about you. And we've heard so often from Mr. Trump that it was about him. Of course, he didn't say that last night, and maybe that's significant. But I think her vision of a sort of, hey, here's the new America. We have to value our differences. We have to respect our differences, and we have to we can't go back. I think that's going to ring down over the next few years as a kind of alternative to perhaps a Trump America.
We can't go back.
I have to say, yes. Tom, you know, yes. I think for all that we complained about Hillary Clinton's lack of authenticity on the campaign trail, mm-hmm. I think we really got some right there in her concession speech.
That's a very late hour. And what an effort put in there. Effort on all sides, but how many years there? And voters saying, at least in the Electoral College, no thank you. Ready for something different, something new. Popular vote, by all accounts at this point, gone to Hillary Clinton. What a moment. We have much more to look at, and we will in the days ahead. Eliana Johnson at the National Review, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Yamiche Alcindor with the New York Times. Yamiche, it's always good to have you here. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks.
And Jack Beatty, thank you for joining us. We'll talk soon.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.